my beloved brothers and sisters, in the patient waiting for Yeshua to come. The matters of praise, of prophecy and salvation are interwoven in the Psalms in a very, very wonderful way. One that excites our earnest desire to understand their meaning. And as we labour to learn the hidden truths, so our hearts and our minds are generated, and all we wish to do as we understand and learn is to praise and to thank our Heavenly Father for the wonders of His Word and for the great privilege that we have of reading it and learning the wonderful things that are here. Now Psalm 48 is no exception, as we shall endeavour to show, and many other questions which no doubt you've noticed as we have read through that psalm together. Now, was it written in the days of Jehoshaphat, when a confederacy of the local nations, the hostile nations, came against him? He was instructed, you will recall, he prayed, he was instructed, "Ye shall stand still and see the salvation of Yahweh." And he and his army went forth singing. The priests led the nation into war, singing, "Praise ye Yahweh, for his mercy endureth forever." And the result was that his enemies fought one another. And the record tells us that there was none that escaped death. And later, some 160 years later, we have Hezekiah. And there, brothers and sisters, he was, in the words of Sennacherib, shut up like a bird in a cage. And he too, through earnest prayer, was enabled to see the salvation of Yahweh. For you remember, in the morning there were 185,000 Assyrians dead. Just one little point that I have overlooked, and that is, going back to the times of Jehoshaphat there, he made an affinity with Ahaziah, you remember, the wicked king of Israel, and it says in the last verse of the 2nd of Chronicles chapter 20, "And the ships were broken and they were not able to go to Tarshish." I just slip that in at the moment, just to, as we have to think about this beautiful 48th psalm and so on. Well, so how fitting then were the prayers of these two great kings in Israel? Was the psalm used by them? Well, we don't know really, and we cannot tell. But many of the psalms, brothers and sisters, as you probably know, are prophetic. They are prophetic, and their fulfillment sometimes has one or two fulfillments. For instance, if you look at Psalm 2, we learn there that, coming to Acts chapter 4, verse 25, there we read a portion of that psalm, and it says, "Who by the mouth of thy servant David has said, why did the heathen rage and the people imagine a vain thing? The kings of the earth set themselves, and they came against the anointed," and so it goes on. So there is a first application of Psalm 2, for instance. But we know that it has a far greater and more wonderful fulfillment, because it tells us, "He that sitteth in the heavens shall laugh, he shall have them in derision, yet have I set my king upon my holy hill of Zion." And again, we see the Lord Jesus Christ in the Psalms, do we not? Just pick up Psalm 23, for instance. "So well known, so little understood. Yahweh is my shepherd. He maketh me to lie down in green pastures." And that means amongst the revitalized green grass of nations. That's what it means, brothers and sisters. Their spirit is quieted at that time, when the nations will be amenable to divine law and will gladly obey. And so later in that psalm you read, David and his immortal companions are led beside the still waters. Oh, lovely, brothers and sisters. Time is coming when the nations will be quieted. They will become like the translucent sea, as we have it in the Apocalypse. once turbulent, once unteachable, and antagonistic, now made like the still waters. And so we apply then these great truths as we come to this Psalm 48. And we are enabled to see many, many wondrous things. Together, just let us briefly run down the psalm, and you will note some of the little problems or the questions that need an answer. Because looking at verses 1 to 3, you say, well, what is the city? What is the mountain of its holiness? Why is its situation so beautiful and joyous, and so on? Coming down to verse 4, we say, well, who are the kings who are assembled there, who passed by, who marvelled, who were troubled and hasted away? Who are they? Fear taking hold upon them. Dropping down to verse 7, we say, well, what are the ships of Tarshish? We just looked at them in the days of Jehoshaphat. But what are the ships of Tarshish? Why are they broken? By what means are they broken? And so the questions come into our minds. And so as we follow the psalm down, brothers and sisters, there we are introduced to the holy name of the Father in verse 9 and 10 and so on. And we ask the question, well, who are, in the next verse, who are the daughters of Judah in the 11th verse? And why are they to walk about Zion? What are they to see when they walk about Zion? And they are to tell it, to tell what they see to another generation. And so you can see, brothers and sisters, we have quite a few things to try to understand together as we reflect upon this matter. And so, returning then to the opening verses of this psalm, rightly we read, great in majesty and power and authority is Yahweh. He who will be manifested or revealed in the Elohim. And you notice in the psalm, brethren and sisters, that this word Elohim is used quite often. It's always the plural word, we understand. The mighty ones of Israel. In whose city? Well, a city is a fortified place. It has a wall. And he, Yahweh, is to be greatly praised in that city and because of that city. And that city is upon a high mountain. And there is holiness, or a hallowing, or a consecration of Yahweh. And now follows its description, as you see it there. Let's quote the verse. Beautiful for situation, the joy of the whole earth is Mount Zion, on the sides of the north, the city of the great king. And so again, brothers and sisters, we realize that such great changes have got to come in Zion, Jerusalem, to make it and to bring to pass that wonderful description that we see there in verse 2. It's goodly for situation. And that really means it's beautiful in height. Let's keep this in mind, brothers and sisters, this matter of height. As it rises up, as one beholds this wonderful edifice, this great city with its mile square walls, it is the object of joy. It is the object of gladness and delight and veneration above all other places upon the earth, all other objects of desire. And so the mountain of Zion, Jerusalem, is elevated, it is lifted up. And thus it is a very, very beautiful city of mighty ones. And it's seen upon the mountains of Israel. You remember how Ezekiel in the 40th chapter, verse 2, there he sees this wonderful city. He was set upon a very high mountain, a very high mountain, which was, as he saw, as it were, the frame of a city on the south. Now, just picking this up very quickly in the scriptures, you will remember, brothers and sisters, that when we come to Zechariah chapter 14, there we have a description regarding this city, and it tells us what is to happen. Verse 4, His feet shall stand in that day upon the Mount of Olives, which is before Jerusalem on the east, and the Mount of Olives shall cleave in the midst thereof toward the east, toward the west, and there shall be a very great valley. And half of the mountain shall remove toward the north, half of it toward the south. And just dropping down to verse 10, and all the land shall be turned as a plain from Geba to Rimmon, south of Jerusalem, and it shall be lifted up and inhabited in her place, and so it goes on. So the description there by Zechariah. Now, roughly speaking, Geba is about 6 or 7 miles north of Jerusalem, and Rimmon is supposed to be about 28 miles to the south. And so here then is an area, brethren and sisters, which is to be lifted up. It's an area of some 40 square miles. It is to be lifted up, and the Dead Sea also is to be affected. And this is the site of this great temple with its mild square wall. Just think, brethren and sisters, how ridiculous it would be to put a tiny little temple, as those who advocate the small temple, upon a great area of some 40 square miles, lifted up. Doesn't bear comparison, does it? And so, brethren and sisters, therefore, we see Jerusalem, Zion, lifted up as a tableland, some 3,819 feet, adding together the present height and the depth down to the Dead Sea. There you have the height that it will be in that glorious and wonderful day. There it is, with all the surrounding terrain round about it, all luscious and green, brethren and sisters, as only the Father can bring to pass, indeed, like the Garden of Eden. And there we see then this wonderful house of prayer for all nations, and so on, encompassed about with its wonderful buildings, its surroundings, such as the world has never seen. Now, the expression then, on the sides of the north, because that's perhaps what you're thinking about, what does it mean? Well, it means the most remote region, or, as Brother Sully expresses it in his book, at the extreme point northwards, or the limit of the northern side. And so, brethren and sisters, can we not visualize then a tableland high and lifted up, as we observed it, or could observe it, as it will be from the dormitory city Yahweh Shammah, which is 20 miles to the south of this? Can you not vision going up to Zion, to Jerusalem, and beholding there this wonderful construction with its beautiful stonework glittering through what, brethren and sisters? All the vinery, all the palm trees, and the great luscious plants of that kind, which will grow up into that building. Try and imagine it, brethren and sisters, all bearing luscious fruits and so on, because that will be the vision, brethren and sisters. And so you realize then, to my mind, we're seeing the fulfillment in part of the beautiful Feast of Tabernacles. It pointed forward to the kingdom, you remember, when Israel dwelt in booths, and they were formed of palm trees, of willows of the brook, and branches of thick trees, and so on. And there they enjoyed divine fellowship for those 7 days in their history, and so on. Here we see the wonderful antitype of this in part. Now we're thinking then of verse 3 now, because who dwells, or who officiates in this altogether wonderful house of prayer? Why, the Elohim, the mighty ones of the Spirit, the sons and daughters of Yahweh according to their courses. That's another beautiful thought. Can't stop to extend it, brethren and sisters. But if you go back into David's appointments and you reflect upon the first of Chronicles, chapters 28 to from chapter 23 to chapter 28, there you will see the appointments that David made in his kingdom. very, very a type and shadow there, brethren and sisters, of that which is to be. And so the word palace is there means a lofty fortress. And such will be this great refuge from sin and death for all the nations in the kingdoms. And thus it will become a rock, a lofty place, affording eternal shelter and security to the heeding, I'll underline that, to the heeding mortals of the nation. And so the temple is completed, it's made ready to receive its first worshippers. And this will be, brethren and sisters, when all the enemies of Yahweh are put down, and the results of the divine authority will then be felt throughout all the earth. And it is, study the word, you'll find it is a long period of 40 years. The temple is built during a time of warfare, actually. 40 long years. How do we know this? Well, when you go to Revelation chapter 14 and you look there at verse 7, there we have presented to us the hour of his judgment. The hour of his judgment. And the hour in Scripture, of course, is 30 years on the principle of a day for a year. And that is followed by a time of period of preaching to the nations of 10 years. No, Thomas is not emphatic upon this, but it seems, brethren and sisters, to be the case, because you have an interval of 10 days, as you go back into Leviticus 23, verse 24, you have an interval of 10 days between the memorial of the blowing of trumpets and the Day of Atonement some 10 years later on, and you find that in verse 27. So a period of 40 years. Well, returning then to our psalm, to Psalm 48, and we look at verse 4 now. And there it tells us, For lo! And it means that, brethren and sisters, for lo, behold, see! Something to be excited about. As the world, brethren and sisters, as the world rulers, now in place and power, become the objects of divine wrath, as they will be, and the extent of the land covenanted to Abraham is freed from the Nile to the Euphrates, as Gog is destroyed, as the beasts of Daniel chapter 7 are subjected to Yahshua and the saints, as the dreadful fourth beast of papal Europe is no more, and the Americas, have their power taken away from them, and the almighty dollar is no more. So, the high ones, the captive kings and rulers, are finally brought to Zion to behold its wonders and its glories. We ought to read, really, Joshua chapters 10, 11 and 12. But we'll just notice chapter 10 and verse 24. And it's the occasion, you will remember, brothers and sisters, when the sun stood still, and there Yahweh poured down great stones upon the enemies of Joshua at that particular time, and they died. Wonderful types and shadows of things which are to come. But we must content ourselves with verse 23, and there the five kings were put out, or taken out of the cave, and verse 24, and it came to pass, when they brought out those kings unto Joshua, that Joshua called for all the men of Israel, and said unto the captains of the men of war which were with him, come near, put your feet upon the necks of these kings. And they came near, and put their feet upon the necks of them, and Joshua said unto them, fear not, be not dismayed. And so the narrative goes on. We can, yes, let's go to Psalm 149, one we quote so many times, and there, verse 5, let the saints be joyful in glory, let them sing aloud upon their beds, let the high praises of God be in their mouth, and a two-edged sword in their hand, to execute vengeance upon the nations, and punishments upon the people, to bind their kings with chains and their nobles with fetters of iron, to execute upon them the judgment written, dishonor. Dishonor have all his saints. Praise ye Yahweh. And another one, brethren and sisters, a threefold cord is not easily broken. Let's go to the 24th chapter of Isaiah now. 24th chapter of Isaiah, verse 20, he tells us there that the earth is going to reel to and fro like a drunkard when the divine judgments come. And verse 21, and it shall come to pass in that day that Yahweh shall punish the host of the high ones that are on high, and the kings of the earth upon the earth, and they shall be gathered together. They shall be gathered together as prisoners are gathered in the pit, and shall be shut up in the prison, and after many days they shall be visited. And the result is, and the moon shall be confounded, and the sun ashamed, when Yahweh shall reign in Mount Zion before his ancients gloriously. Wonderful pictures, brothers and sisters, but what great truths are here. Well now, at this juncture, it is necessary for us to divert a little, and I want us to think about the words of Paul in Hebrews chapter 2. Hebrews chapter 2, I'll quote it for you. For unto the angels hath he not put in subjection the world to come whereof we speak. It would appear then, brethren and sisters, that after the truly wonderful scene that we have in Revelation chapter 5, where angels of two orders are meeting together, the Elohim, the fingers of God's hand of Genesis chapter 1, and the brethren of Yahshua anointed, and there, remember, thou hast made it unto our God kings and priests, and we shall reign on the earth. That is what they sing, brethren and sisters, acclaiming the Lamb in their midst. And it would appear now that from this juncture the angels who have so faithfully overseen the affairs of men are withdrawn from the scene, and the glorified and immortal saints, the Christ body, will begin their great work of instituting the kingdom of God upon the earth. Reflect for a moment, brethren and sisters, upon the words of faithful Hannah in the 1st of Samuel chapter 2. You remember them surely. Yahweh maketh poor and maketh rich. He bringeth low and lifteth up. He raiseth up the poor out of the dust, lifteth up the beggar from the dunghill, to set them among princes, and to make them inherit the throne of glory. Similar words were echoed by Mary, you remember. Let's go to 1st of Luke chapter 50, just to build up our minds with these most wonderful things. There in Luke chapter 1 verse 50, his mercy is on them that fear him from generation to generation. He hath showed strength with his arm. He hath scattered the proud in the imagination of their hearts. He hath put down the mighty from their seats, exalted them of low degree. He hath filled the hungry with good things, and the rich hath he sent empty away. With hope in his servant Israel, in remembrance of his mercy, as he spake to our father, to Abraham, to his seed, forever. And so it goes on. Now, brethren and sisters, the true ecclesia, understanding these great truths, will, in all humility, even now, appreciate the honour bestowed upon them, and will greatly rejoice at the wonderful prospect of being made like unto the angels. Now, just a little exhortation here. Brethren and sisters, you remember, help us Israel, Brother Thomas there, he says, the Father cannot bestow upon you that which you are not expecting or have no faith in. Put that in the context of our subject, brethren and sisters. Father cannot give you things which you are not expecting and which you have no faith. Very, very sobering indeed. And so we look at ourselves. We have been exhorted today. We look at ourselves. Here we are, weak and erring, conscious of our feelings, our failings. But, brethren and sisters, surely the word that is within us as a fire, surely it motivates us. It helps us to overcome all our difficulties. We lift up our vision beyond these times and we see the wonderful things of glory which are to come, when we shall become the very sons of power, the Elohim of the age to come. This is the Father's promise to us. And so at this juncture then, brethren and sisters, we ought to meditate upon Revelation chapter 10. Revelation chapter 10, realizing that the angels pour out the seven vials, but the saints themselves are responsible for the seven thunders. John was representative of his brethren in that chapter, well, the whole of the Apocalypse. And verse 11 tells us, John, thou must prophesy again before many peoples and nations and tongues and kings. And so we have tried to remind one another then, brethren and sisters, of the glory set before us. And now look how verse 7 of this 48th Psalm magnifies and brings into focus all these wonderful truths. You know, we're apt to think of Armageddon and the stone falling upon the feet of the image as the immediate prelude to the coming of the establishing of the kingdom of God. Well, but that event is but the commencement of the judgments of the Father, as we've already tried to show. The power of Gog and Magog and all the armies of the nations who think an evil thought will come into the land, and there will be no more. We know that Rome, the papal system, will sink into the abyss, gone forever. The king of the north, referring to in Daniel chapter 11, will be conquered. But what of the king of the south? What of the king of the south? Britain, the old lion, with her family of young lions. Scattered throughout the earth, brothers and sisters, are large nations, small nations, many, many islands, which all give their allegiance to this country. This country in which, thankfully, by divine providence, we have shelter now. Together, as you know, they are called the Commonwealth countries. We might think of Britain as the champion of the oppressed, as the haven of the underprivileged, etc. But what of the divine estimation, brethren and sisters? Ezekiel 38 verse 2 says, Son of man, say unto the prince of Tyrus, Thus saith Adonai Yahweh, Because thine heart is lifted up, and thou hast said, I am a God, I sit in the seat of God, in the midst of the seas, yet thou art a man. What's coming into our mind? The great national song, is it not? Britannia rules the waves. And so, again, in Isaiah 23 verse 8, there it tells us, Who hath taken this counsel against Tyre, the crowning city whose merchants are princes, whose traffickers are the honourable of the earth? Yahweh of hosts hath purposed it, to stain the pride of all glory, and to bring into contempt all the honourable of the earth. What is the determined destiny of this haughty and adulterous system, brethren and sisters? We've got to think about it. It's so important. And so, coming now to verse 7 of our psalm, I trust that you will marvel with me at what unfolds. And firstly, I would point out to you that four of the psalms that we're dealing with today all mention Tyre or Tarshish. How significant! Tarshish rightly is the commercial system, the expertise whereby Tyre which refers to the headquarters, the land centre of the system. Together they are the merchant power of the earth, the Tarshish Tyrian of the last days, Britain. Tyre in its history, days of Alexander, fled to the island. From the island it had to move, as Brother Alan has indicated to us. She moved to Alexandria, and then to Venice, to Genoa, to Lisbon, Holland, and lastly, she settled here in these shores of Britain. No longer a manufacturing power, it's not necessary. The workshop of the world, as she was, but now, the pivot of the world's financial affairs, the bank counter of the world, handling the world's money, playing the harlot at the same time. Do we go into Europe or do we not? There she is, brothers and sisters. And she's steeped in tradition, is she not? Pride and tradition, boasting of her 1,000 years democratic rule, of her wisdom, of her political diplomacy, priding herself in her monarchy, her royalty, and so on. And we come to verse 7, and you notice there, thou breakest. What's it mean? Thou breakest the ships of Tarshish. It means to burst, to crush, to destroy, to break altogether, to break into pieces. What is meant then by the breaking of the ships of Tarshish by an east wind? Well, men have given their lives to bring this great system alive in the world, have they not? Well, the ships, brethren and sisters, that which brings earthly pleasures, wealth, and the desires of the flesh, that is really the understanding, the medium by which all these things are brought to pass. Just let's go to Isaiah chapter 2, and there you notice verse 11, the lofty looks of man shall be humbled, the haughtiness of men shall be bowed down. Yahweh alone shall be exalted in that day, for the day of Yahweh of hosts shall be upon every one that is proud and lofty, but every one that is lifted up. And he goes on, verse 13, upon all the cedars of Lebanon that are high, upon all the oaks of Bashan, upon all the high mountains, upon all the hills, verse 15, upon every high tower, every fenced wall, and upon all the ships of Tarshish, and upon all pleasant places. Now the context of these verses, as you look at it now, shows that they are not to be understood literally. The day of Yahweh of armies, of hosts, is upon the cedars of Lebanon, the oaks of Bashan, the high mountains, as well as the little hills and so on. But the wrath of Yahweh will not be upon literal trees, literal mountains, upon the nations and powers represented by these figures. So if trees and mountains are symbols, so are the ships. Surely we see the point there. So what then of the east wind? Well, you remember in Revelation 16 and verse 12, there it speaks of the drying up of the Euphrates, and then it tells us, does it not, of the coming into being of the kings of the sun rising. Malachi chapter 4, sun right with his beam drying up out of the earth. Well, the saints, is it not? And so the saints now are a new family of mighty ones. They are the Elohim. They are overseeing, as we tried to show, the divine will. Their mighty king is Yahshua at their head. And now they are seen directing the mortal armies of Israel as the angels did in former years. And so, just one quotation in this regard. Isaiah 51, and there it says, thou Israel art my battle axe and weapons of war, for with thee I will break in pieces the nations, and with thee and I will destroy the kingdoms. And so there, brethren and sisters, the saints, they're like the angels now, ordering world's affairs, so they order the armies of Israel, and the armies of Israel execute the divine wrath. Now, I just want to read to you the words of Brother Thomas regarding Ezekiel chapter 28. He says, Britain at the last had to contend with both Babylon and with the stones of fire. His words were, the British power will have to contend with the whole strength of Babylon, which will prevail against her so far as to expel her from Egypt, from Jerusalem and Palestine, and she will fall, not by Babylon the Great, but by the stones of fire, the saints, and before the great city is overthrown to rise no more. These stones of fire are Christ, the precious stone, and the saints, the living stones. Remember Peter's words? From whom a fiery destruction, the Jews being the channel, will stream forth against the daughter of Tyre or Britain and all the continental kingdoms of the earth inhabitable. These stones of fire are the kings that shall look upon the Tyrian harlot prostrate at their feet. They are Yahweh's kings who shall utterly abolish the empire of Britain. They will reduce the nations of the British Isles to perfect subjection to the King of Israel dwelling at Jerusalem, the royal family, the hereditary nobles, the orders of their harlot churches, her merchant princes, legislators and gentry, as the stars of the Tyrian heavens will be cast to the ground, deprived of honour, wealth, position and power, which will be appropriated by the victors. The merchant kingdom will be reduced to ashes by judicial fire destined to devour her within and without. And so Brother Thomas goes on. Better than I can describe it, brothers and sisters. And so just coming down to our few more verses now in our chapter. There you will notice, let Mount Zion rejoice in verse 11. Let the daughters of Judah be glad. We just read why they should be glad. And then you have this beautiful phrase, walk about Zion. That's a wonderful picture we try to look at, brethren and sisters. The house of prayer for all nations. The most beautiful edifice that this world has ever seen. So tremendously high, with wonderful towers in the corners there. Walk about Zion, go round about her, tell the towers thereof, mark you well her bulwarks, and so on. Now, just let's pause for a moment. What's the word mark mean? Well, it means to turn the heart and the mind to regard. And then what does behold her bulwarks mean? Well, it means her forces, her mighty ones, her armies, the saints, of course, brethren and sisters. And so, reading on, it says, tell it to the generation following in the kingdom age. So those who follow on in the kingdom age are going to be shown the wonders of Zion. And then it's going to be said to them, this is what you may become, like the Elohim, the sons and daughters of the Most High, whom you observe there in the temple. You may become, if you have the faith, and you will learn, if you learn. And so, brothers and sisters, the Elohim then, you and I, if we are found worthy, will be our guide unto death. The Elohim will be there, guiding the nations, even unto death. What does it mean there? It doesn't mean exactly unto death. It means eternity, forever. That's what it means. That is the promise to those who in the kingdom, the mortal inhabitants, will pay heed and observe all that Zion stands for and the saints in that particular time. Now, one could go on, but in conclusion, as already been pointed out to us, brothers and sisters,
note the psalm is of the sons of Korah. We've already been reminded of the sons of Korah. But did not their progenitors stand back and would have no part in the dreadful rebellion of their father Korah? We've already looked at Numbers 16. But were they not found as the singers of praises to Yahweh in David's kingdom? Because our psalm here tells us a song and psalm of the sons of Korah. The sons of Korah. And so, how better can we conclude these few brief thoughts, brethren and sisters, by saying, may you and I, my brother and my sister, be faithful to the real truth. This is what we try to present. The real truth as our forebears understood it. They were thrilled by these things, brothers and sisters. Gradually the vision is fading, and it will do ere the Lord comes. But for us, we will concentrate our minds upon the real truth, that in the mercy of the Father, our eternal voices may be heard amongst that immortal choir who will with joy and gladness praise Yahweh day and night. That's what it tells us, day and night in his holy temple.